Blog Talk Radio. Good afternoon, everyone. Happy Tuesday before Christmas. It's Tuesday, December 22nd, and this is Laura Levine talking to you from Anacortes, Washington on Fidalgo Island. This is chez Laura, and we have a great show today. I'm really, really excited. You can visit me at lauralevine.com. I need to let you know that my hard drive crashed this past week, and so I'm rebuilding my website. So it's there, but it's not updated, which doesn't matter that much. And I've been making cookies instead of working on it. So it's going to get up there when it gets up there. But I'm really glad we're all on the phone together, on the air together today. And my guest is really special today. My guest is Al Turtle. And I'll give you a little background on how I came to know Al. A friend of mine several years ago gave me an article that he had printed from his computer called Getting to Know Your Lizard or something like that. And it was pretty long, and I took my time and read it, and something just clicked for me. The wisdom was so profound and so helpful. And I have been using this, the concept of the lizard, which we'll talk about today, in my work for years now. And I was so fascinated with it that I wanted to know more about this man who had written this article. And so I did. I went on his website and I read everything I could get my eyes on, which maybe I didn't even read all because he's really prolific. But an immense amount of wisdom about relationships. And he's been my mentor, even though I have never met him in person. He's been my mentor for years because I'm always quoting him, sending people to his website, using it in my own life. And so today I am just beyond excitement to have him on the show. So I can ask him a lot of questions. And if you want to call, please call in. It's 347-945-6642. And I will try to bring you in to talk with Al as well. So with no further ado, here is Al Turtle. Hi, Al.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon to everybody.
Good afternoon to you. Where are you?
I am in northern Idaho. Fresh dropping snow out here on top of rain for 4 days, and that means that the deer tracks are really visible.
Oh,
and that's wonderful. We go out in the morning. My wife and I go and take a walk every morning for about 40 minutes. It's one of the little rituals that holds everything together. And but our walk leads us up a road that all these animals pass by, and we just love it. If there are lots of animals, if there are elk and coyote and deer out there, tracks at least, then we think it's a better day.
Yeah, walking in their footsteps. So one of the little rituals, I'm going to want to know more about all of this. Can you tell us, I mean, there is so much I want to ask you. I don't even know what to begin with, but I know that I want to know a little bit about you, how you came to do what you do, whatever you want to share about your personal experiences in relationships. And then I want to know more about everything else. But let's start with this, because I don't know much about that part, and I think it's really nice to hear how you came to do the work that you do.
Wow. Wow. You asked me to tell a story. That's only about 6 hours long. So
I know. I told you. This isn't just not going to work in an hour.
Yeah, I hear you. I'm actually originated in Boston, and came from a pretty, I don't know, proper Bostonian family, maybe you'd say. My dad was a doctor, and he was a pediatrician. So I was always aware of a man who was taking care of babies. Mm. And one of his great puzzles in life was teenagers. He kept thinking if you do it right in childhood that things should be better in teenagers.
Oh,
and
boy.
Of course, he didn't have any idea what to do right. So therefore, my brother and sister and I had trouble as teenagers. I think that was sown into me pretty deeply, this idea of how your childhood experiences and learning affect what goes on later in life. So that was easy. Then I was married for 17 years and ended up divorced, and it blew me away. Now, I'm a technician by trade. I like to put my hands.
You are?
Yeah, and I like to fix things.
Okay.
So I just took that. I'd known how to fix all electronics. I was in the Navy, and I fixed electronics and stuff like that. And I took that same kind of mentality and put it onto this relationship. And I just said, you know, I started off by saying, well, the whole problem was my wife's. And then I decided...
Wait, so how long into the marriage did you know things were not going well?
Things have been rough. Well, the day she told me that I could make all the unimportant decisions and she would make all the important ones, I kind of knew something was wrong.
Right.
I knew something was wrong probably 7 or 8 years into the relationship, but
okay.
I struggled and struggled, and it was 17 years before suddenly one day she announced she was divorcing me.
Hmm.
And this, I think I approached it, I approached it the first way anyone would. For about the next couple of months, I was a basket case.
Mm-hmm.
And I was...
Did you think you were happy in the relationship?
Did I think I was happy?
Uh-huh.
No. I thought everything was okay and adequate.
Okay.
And I thought I was doing my job. And there were many happy things I did because I had 3 kids.
Okay.
And I lived in Montana for a while during that period. And it was a wonderful place to live. But things just... We just never were able to form the teamwork that I'd always dreamed a relationship would be.
Mm-hmm.
And
had you seen that from your parents, the teamwork?
They did teamwork, but they were pretty independent, and the level of intimacy was pretty low in the family.
Okay.
So I really wasn't taught intimacy. I was taught maybe cooperation,
mm-hmm.
but not intimacy. Certainly not anything like validation. It was easier for me to go off in the forest alone than
right.
it was to be in the family. I remember one time being really, really upset and deciding I was going to run away from home. I think I was probably about 8. And I ran away to a tree in the backyard. And I went up this tree, and unfortunately from the tree I could see my family having dinner and not giving a damn that I was out in the tree.
Oh, ouch.
And, of course, that was their plan of getting me back in, which
was... Yeah, that was your perception.
But it hurt a lot. And it had hurt a lot all the way along, this kind of, lack of intimacy that I, as a kid, needed.
Yeah.
I need a lot of intimacy. So basically everything I've...
God, I love hearing a man say that. Can you say that again just one more time?
Uh-oh.
I need a lot of intimacy. Anybody else listening over there?
I'm one of those clinger men.
All right.
I'd say about in my office, about 40% of the men who come in the office are clinger men. And they need intimacy. And they're typically married to an isolating mother.
Mother.
Yeah, you heard me.
Nobody else did. We'll just edit that out.
Yeah. So I identify with them pretty easily, but I also identify with the clinging women who are married to isolating men.
Right.
You know, because my wife's taught me all about what isolating is like and why you do it and what it's all about on the inside.
Your first wife?
No, my second wife.
Your second wife, okay.
My first wife was the same way, but I never knew.
Okay. So that's interesting. So you think you... Well, see, here I have too many questions. Okay, go back to your marriage.
Well, we went through a divorce. I had 3 kids. And in the process of the divorce, the kids decided to live with me,
wow.
which was stunning because they were teenagers. Terrible time to get a divorce. And I was miserable alone. Me being a man who needs intimacy, waking up Saturday morning and wondering who the heck I can connect with for the weekend was a terrible time.
How old were you?
When I got divorced, 38.
Okay.
So I decided that I somebody said that relationship was something you had to practice. Somebody told me that at something. And I decided I better start practicing. And so I didn't say I was going to get remarried. I went out and practiced relationships. And
so you dated a lot.
I dated a lot. But I was thinking about, you know, looking inside, finding out what kind of a partner I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking at myself as at least half of the problem in my relationship, my first marriage. So
without counseling, you were able to leave the marriage and come to the realization that it wasn't all her. I was 50%.
Yeah, and I think that's a matter of the technician model in my head, that if you're trying to communicate between one radio receiver on one ship and another on the other one, you do a lot of speculating on which receiver is the one that's got the problem.
Uh-huh.
And you end up ascribing responsibility to each one of them, you know. And I think I was using that same model and saying, wait a minute, it's not all one, not all the other. In fact, my model right now is that when you're in relationship, you might as well just say that blame should be distributed 50%. I don't think 100. I don't think I should take 100. I take 100% responsibility for my 50%.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I don't take responsibility for my wife's 50%. That's one of the terrible mistakes in relationship.
Right.
Is to lift off of your partner their responsibility and thereby give them the hint that they don't have to do anything. Oh, boy, is that trouble.
Well,
anyway,
yeah.
So after 5 years of this stoking around and looking people, I finally decided I was ready to get remarried. And of course, within about a week, I met my next wife. And 5 years later, we were struggling as much as I had in the first marriage.
Oh, no. So how quickly did you get married?
It took 5 years between. In fact, I'd read a book that said men should wait 5 years. It's wrong, but that's what I had at the time.
But I mean, after you met her.
After I met her, we got married in a year.
Okay. And 5 years later, you're in the same boat.
At 5 years, we were in the same boat. Well, 5 years from the time we met.
Yeah,
because
okay.
We met and started acting like husband and wife, even though we had separate houses. And then we started moving in with each other. And then we just said, okay, get married.
Okay.
But we were having the same trouble. And I'd done a lot of personal therapy in the meantime. But personal therapy really doesn't touch relationship stuff.
Right.
It does improve some stuff, but it doesn't improve the relationship stuff. You've got to do that in a relationship.
But in all your years of dating, had you been practicing some skills?
I was learning some skills, but I would say I learned less than 1% during that time. And before,
because there
wasn't
the commitment, probably.
Yeah.
Okay. So here you are, 5 years later, same stuff.
Same stuff. And so then I just said, well, wait a minute. I was a counselor at the time, and I'd done a lot of therapy, and it hadn't had any effect. I mean, the signaling event was that I was arguing with my wife at 1 o'clock in the morning, and she went to sleep in the middle of a sentence.
Okay.
Now, that's an isolator for you.
Yeah.
It's also a lizard. You know, lizard.
Yes,
that's
submit.
Not easy. She did it. But my first wife had done that.
Really?
That exactly same behavior. And I suddenly said, this is the same woman. And I went really scared.
Wow.
And then I said, I've got to do something. I've got to do something radical. And so that's when I started, and I dug up Harvo Hendrix's work. He happened to be published at that time.
So for those of you who are listening and don't know who Harvo Hendrix is, he has written two really fabulous books. One is called Getting the Love You Want, and the other one is called Keeping the Love You Find.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so wait a second. Did you say you were counseling or you were in counseling?
I was both.
Okay, so you had moved from being in the Navy to counseling.
Yes, I moved.
Okay.
I moved from the Navy back in the end of '60s and moved and got a degree in counseling by '72.
Okay. So you were doing relationship counseling or individual counseling?
I was doing individual counseling because I really didn't know that I knew what relationship counseling was.
Okay, all right.
But I had also been doing a lot of my own personal therapy. I did some pretty deep Wilhelm Reich, what's called organ therapy.
Okay.
And I'd done that for about 9 years, and that helped me with learning to express emotions and being comfortable with my emotional body as being central to my life. I was raised in a family where no one was allowed to have emotions. So that completely shifted me. But it didn't fix my relationship skills, except
I was raised in a family where the only emotion that, well, I shouldn't say that, but I think a big value was placed on drama versus emotions.
Well, that can be our family was a no drama, and the only emotion allowed was fear.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. Right. Right.
And so everybody, of course, wanted to leave, which
yes.
Everybody did. It's still, they didn't talk about leaving and get rid of the fear. They just kept the fear.
The lizard. Okay. So one in the morning, she falls asleep during an argument and you dig up Harville Hendrix.
I dig up Harville Hendrix. I got the book, read it, loved it, embraced it. It made so much sense to me as a technician and understanding relationships.
So you're talking about the imago, right?
I was talking about the imago, and I was also, by the way, clinger avoider is directly in that book. It's the first time I'd run into that concept.
Give a little background on the imago, because I'm sure some of our listeners don't know. And oh my gosh, wait, you guys, till you hear about this. I mean, yikes! If you're not ready, you should turn off the radio now and go have ice cream.
Well. Up until, I'd say, around 1982, we thought that the problem of marriage was rounding out and picking the right person, and there was something wrong. People were getting divorced because they were picking the wrong person. And by 1980 or so, we had now proved to ourselves, this is marriage counselors as a faction, had proved to ourselves that people always pick the wrong person. That you will at some point, no matter who you marry, you will at some point say, this person next to me in bed is my worst nightmare.
Uh-huh.
And we hadn't yet figured out why, but we had seen that this was a pretty universal. As long as you marry a person you fall in love with, this works.
They eventually become your worst nightmare.
They will eventually become your best dream when you fall in love with them, and that sets up that they will be your worst nightmare at some point.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because it's kind of like you can't have joy without having, you can't have the positive emotions without having the negative emotions.
Right, and they also, they're going to be your biggest teachers.
So they're going to be your biggest challenge, and they're your biggest challenge because they're intimate with you.
Right.
So what's the worst you can ever have is to be somebody who's a terrible challenge and you're locked up in a small house with them.
And you have your heart attached to them.
Yeah, yeah.
So when did he write the book? I have it here. I can't find when he wrote it.
He wrote about 87.
87, okay.
86 or 87. And it was after the discovery that that there is within each one of us, set up about by age 6 or 7, a durable picture of the ideal partner. And that durable picture has enormous number of features to it, both positive and negative, what you'd call is positive and negative.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it is that durable picture that you hold in your kind of unconscious mind when you're out dating. And the closer somebody is to that durable picture, the more your heart leaps towards them.
Right. So 6 or 7.
It's pretty well firm at 6 and 7, and it never changes.
Okay.
And once we understood that, this is why people kept saying, well, you're just as bad as my father, or you're just as bad as my mother.
Right.
Because that durable picture is assembled by looking at your father and your mother and any other caretaker that you had.
Mm-hmm.
And so that will be a kind of, I didn't believe this stuff, by the way, completely. It was after I started doing imago therapy with couples, and about on the 100th couple, it fit again for the 100th time in a row. I finally said, okay, it works. And so if somebody comes up and said, oh, my first wife's nothing like my second wife, I'll say, bet me. I have that level of confidence.
Yeah.
This just works.
Okay, Age 6, we get imprinted, and this is our dating life is set.
basically the our love life, the person we're going to be attracted to. So it sets up the ones we turn down, and it sets up the ones we just look across the room and we start moving after them.
Okay.
I have a friend who says that when he goes into a room of people, he will be standing next to the greatest psycho witch in within 4 or 5 minutes. Well, his
and
mother,
he knows it, and he knows it.
You know, he now knows this. And his mother was a psycho witch.
Right. Right, you know, right. So then other characteristics could be workaholics.
Well, but workaholic's not necessarily a relationship issue. No, workaholic is a behavior, is an addiction, you know, type of addiction.
So would you say unavailable partners?
Well, a workaholic may be unavailable, but they're, if depending upon the type of work, they may be expressing their need for connection at their work.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So I see, for example, I've seen probably 2,600 couples.
Oh, my goodness.
And when they come in the door, one of the most and of course, they only come in if they're in trouble.
Well, yeah.
So this is not average people. This is people who not only are in trouble, which is most of them out there, but also ones who are in trouble and are interested in getting fixed.
Right.
So they come in the door. They have been trying to fix things for a long time, and one way they fix things is by having different work shifts. Because when they're together, it's a strain. So one that they work on, the guy works at night and the woman works during the day.
Right.
Or the guy goes off to work. Or the woman goes off to work and leaves the guy at home.
Oh, my God. I did that for years. Oh, geez. I never thought of that.
And it's really just an attempt to make things easier or make things better by reducing how much you're together.
Of course.
And
okay,
there's nothing wrong with that.
So
it's beautiful.
How does the healing come with the imago?
How does the healing come?
Yeah.
Wow, there's a big jump. Healing.
Well, I mean, I want to give our listeners a rounded picture of...
Sure.
So you know, we're attracted to this person that we've imprinted at a really young age. And from what I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, what I understand is that the purpose is to heal what we couldn't heal as kids.
Okay. I'm okay with that. With that languaging, and that is.
Are you sure?
I'm okay with it. You hear me? That isn't. I'm enthusiastic about it.
No, I can tell.
But I am okay with it. So let's be a little more careful.
Okay.
There tend to be two areas that couples work on. The first area is almost universal in the United States. We are, I think, woefully miseducated on how to do relationships. This has nothing to do with our imago partner. It has to do with humans.
Right.
We are trained to argue.
Okay.
We are trained to competitively defeat the person we're with. If you do that in business, that's okay. But if you do that alone at home with a partner, what you're doing is making them into a loser so that you can feel good.
So that's a power struggle, ongoing power struggle.
That's part of the power struggle, and I had competitiveness. If you got competitiveness in within you, you're going to have a challenge in a relationship, because it really means that for you to feel good, for you to win, you have to make your partner into a loser.
Oh, God, that hurts to hear.
And that really hurts. And you can feel both people angling to make to put the other person down.
Yes. Mostly the person we love the most.
Yes. Yeah. And it's only because of competitiveness that is built in 4, 5, 6-year-old stuff. And it can fix it pretty easily. That one's an easy one to fix.
Okay.
Because competitors are very susceptible to what game they're playing. So you just change the game.
Okay, so we're going to have a show just on that part.
You just change the game.
Okay.
You know, it's kind of like when you're playing a game and you're trying to be the one that wins, and then you realize you can't do that, so you try to be the one that loses the worst.
Right,
changing
right.
the game.
Right.
That's just changing.
Right, right.
And you can, and maybe, I think of the game of hearts, the card game of hearts, where you're questioning, are you going to get hearts? Or are you going to get all the hearts?
Oh, right.
There's a decision point there in the game. It's a, because if you really lose, then you're the winner. Well, in competition, it's the same thing. How do you build a relationship? And let's go back to your original thing. Let's talk about the lizard for a second.
Yes, let's talk about the lizard for a week.
Okay.
The lizard's big. Okay. And I still want to know what happened after you started reading the book. So we're going to kind of switch back and forth. Okay.
Okay.
But okay, the lizard, the all important lizard.
All important. So the lizard's involved in everything.
Tell us what the lizard is.
Okay. I guess the best way I can say it, the lizard is an archetype that I partially built. My wife partially built it. It's an archetype for your reptilian brain, for everybody's reptilian brain. It's a way of visualizing, not only giving it a personality, but visualizing its functions in such a way that you can work with it and respect it and protect it. Basically, the way I tend to look at it is that the way all of our brains are structured, we really only have one brain buried down deep, this reptilian brain, and then we have these two big additions that are added onto it to make us a human. So we're kind of reptiles with a mammal and with a primate brain on top of it, and that's the whole of us. But our reptilian brain can operate on its own. If it's operating purely on its own, we call it a coma. You know, and a person in a coma lives pretty comfortably. They don't talk because that's part of the cortex. That's part of the upper brain. But they breathe and they excrete and they do all the things they need to do. And the point is that the lizard does operate on its own. It has an agenda of its own, and it is enormously powerful because it controls the blood flow to all parts of your body. It controls your respiration. It controls everything. And if it's bothered, you're going to be miserable. If it's bothered, let me give an example of it. I think that most of the fibromyalgia-type disorders, fibromyalgia, what's the thing with hands, carpal tunnel,
mm-hmm.
A lot of these things are disorders of the lizard being overactive.
Really?
It's basically your defensive system that is constantly on the alert. And our defensive system isn't designed to be on the alert all the time. It's designed as a fight or flight, quick action behavior. There's a wonderful book called Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers.
Oh, okay. I like that. Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. Okay.
And it's basically a brilliant book done a couple of times by a guy down at Stanford University. It's a good reading on how powerful this reptilian brain is and how it's designed to do what it needs to do in about 5 minutes. And if that doesn't work, you're dead. And if it does work, then you don't eat it anymore because you got the food you're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
So zebras either run like crazy to get away and either get killed in 5 minutes, in which case we don't need any of those long-term things, or it gets away, and then, in which case it turns all the long-term things back on, such as your immune system.
Right. So while your lizard is activated, our immune system shuts down?
If you shut down the immune system, you shut down, you empty your bladder, you empty your bowels, you stop your digestive system, you flood blood away from your skin into your interior, so that you end up with a sick stomach and you end up pale skinned and cold limbed, and your toes and feet and fingers are cold.
And it's a quick one. I mean, you can go from calm to full awake lizard in 2 seconds.
Oh, extremely fast, because it's just a matter of dumping chemistry into your bloodstream, and it hits every part of your body in the split seconds.
So in relationships, the lizard will get activated. Give us an example.
Well, I think I look the other way. It's like, when doesn't it activate? Kind of like every time your lizard activates, you're into some sort of emergency mode. The goal of a relationship is to keep those darn lizards peaceful and not activated.
And to have safety.
Yeah, to have safety, to have your muscles relaxed, to have low levels of adrenaline in your bloodstream, to feel at comfort, to feel secure, to feel trust. Trust is the same thing as a lizard relaxed. So what we basically do is we say, let's say everyone learn to talk about your lizard. And you can talk about your partner's lizard and say,
oh, well, that makes such a difference. I have seen that make such a difference.
And what is your lizard doing today? What is it doing? And well, my lizard was doing really great until the doorbell rang. And then my lizard freaked for a while. And then I answered the door and found it was the mailman. And my lizard was pretty relaxed for a moment. And then I remembered that letter I was worried about getting from my insurance company. And there it was. And my lizard freaked. You know, and you can actually witness this, mm-hmm. and you can witness it in other people because mm-hmm. when the lizard activates, it moves pretty fast.
And it takes about 20 minutes to calm down.
It takes at least 20 minutes. It won't calm down any faster.
So that's a good thing to remember. I remember a few months ago having my lizard went ballistic at something my partner said.
Yep.
And thank God for you. You know, I took a little walk and I waited 25 minutes because in the past, you know, we get to the place where I think I'm always going to feel this bad and I might as well just lash out right now.
Yep.
But a half hour later, oftentimes you're a different person.
Yeah. Yeah. And I call when the lizard, as you say, goes ballistic, I just define that as panic.
Yep.
Now, you can have the lizard can panic in two kind of different overall ways. One is it panics and it runs around like a chicken with your head off. And the other way it panics is by crouching.
Yes.
And stopping to move, and particularly stopping breathing. And, of course, that asphyxiates your cortex and you don't think very well. But either way, when your lizard takes over, that's when we do all our bad stuff. You know, all the stuff we do in our relationship that's really awful that we wish we hadn't done and stuff like that usually is under the influence of somebody's lizard who's active. When you go ballistic, think of the things you tend to do.
Oh, my God, the things I tend to say.
Yeah, and the things you say and the speed with which you move. And this is when guys put their hands through the sheetrock and, you know, all that stuff. And we have these, all of us have these lizards, so we really could get together and have these kind of lizard fests where we could all get together and celebrate our lizards.
Right.
And be thoughtful about them and say, well, you know, I can tell you what makes my lizard happy and you can tell me what makes your lizard happy. And
also, you know, there's a beauty to that it kind of disidentifies it from us. So if I come home and my kids are really agitated, I can see you, what can I do to make your lizard feel better?
Perfect.
As opposed to saying, what the heck is wrong with you?
Yeah, because it's very possible the lizard's operating on things you don't understand or don't know yet. But if you think you should know, if you're upset, you should know why. That can scare somebody's lizard.
Right.
It's really clear if you say to somebody, and I've just said, you try this. Let's say you're really agitated, and I tell you there's no reason to be agitated. That will double your agitation.
That is so scary. Because it's, you know, I feel nuts, and you're telling me on top of it, I'm nuts for feeling nuts.
Yep. Yeah, and so the reverse is so true, and this is where you even get into validation. You learn about validation. You know, if I look at my wife, she comes home and she's twitchy. I don't question that she's twitchy because her lizard's obvious. I just look, as you said, what can I do to help calm you? You know, help make things calm. Mm-hmm. Now, if I say, "What's wrong with your lizard?" that may scare her lizard. But if I just say, if I don't point a finger at her. Because a finger's pointing at some people just kicks their lizard off like crazy.
Yes.
So if you point at them and say that, but if you do it obliquely and by saying, well, let's take a break and just settle down and not do anything heavy for a while. Anything that would make you more comfortable right now, then you're likely to get a better response.
What a gift to have someone say this to us.
Yeah. It's so nice.
So nice, so nice.
And it's so nice to say, well, you don't know why your lizard's upset, but it's obviously got a good reason, so let's go work on it. rather than saying it has no reason.
Yes. So is that what happened after you started to read? I mean, now we're switching back to your experience, and we still have some imago work to do and lived work and critical skills. I really want to talk about critical skills and vintage love, but okay, let's go back to you. So once you started to read.
I hope everybody's been sitting down with seatbelts on. We've been moving pretty fast.
I knew this was going to be messy, but it's okay. It's my show.
It's your show. You can do anything you want.
I can be messy.
I love being messy. But I love structure. You know, for example, this is an hour long. My lizard loves structure. It absolutely adores structure. That's why that ritual in the morning of my going for a walk, that's what rituals are about, is some sort of structure. It's a sense of knowing what's going to happen next.
Yes, yes,
it's a sense of things are under control. My parents did a lot of things under control. So, for example, I used to go to church, and we would arrive chronically 10 minutes before the service. And I'd every day, every Sunday, I had 10 minutes to sit in that pew and, as a little kid, do nothing. That was very difficult, but it was also structure.
Because you were settling into what was coming next.
Because I was settling into a structure and an order. And, you know, as a kid, I was frightened of the dark, but never frightened of closing my eyes in church.
And I think different people have different levels.
Oh, yes.
One of my kids needs that so bad, and I missed it. You know, when our marriage, his dad and my marriage dissolved, I missed how much he needed structure. And,
sure.
You know, I feel bad for that. But I know that if I moved the furniture when he was at school and he would come home, the furniture was moved, it would take him 2 days.
Yeah. It's real fascinating to watch your partners. In fact, if I have a friend, a male friend, who said, after he learned the lizard, he said, you know, it is true that I talk to my wife, but I find myself talking to her lizard a lot.
Oh, yes, 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 yes.
I try to find the language of her lizard, and I talk directly to it. You know, for example, for my wife, she really likes quiet time. So if she gets nervous, I turn off the television or put on a headset and turn off the sound.
Oh, God, what a gift.
And I'm talking to her lizard. When she gets nervous, she likes messes make her nervous. So if she's nervous, I'll start picking up house with her.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, it doesn't do anything to me, but it does do something to comfort me because I'm actually working on comforting her lizard.
Yes, as opposed to saying, what does it matter if the house is messy?
Yeah, exactly. Because, I mean, saying what does it matter, you're actually telling her it doesn't matter when she's already just told you it does matter.
Right. And that's that's where being away from the competition and the power struggles really matter, because it's very easy to say, you know, the house looks fine to me.
Yep.
And I'm just going to drop another towel on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of giving the kindness of saying, I don't need to be competing with you right now. I see that your lizard needs some soothing.
Yeah, I think the beautiful thing about knowing about lizard is you begin to start respecting different points of view. For example, my lizard has one point of view and I have another.
Give me an example.
Well, I remember my wife one day, we were on our morning walk, and she started saying some pretty negative things about North Idaho drivers. And I was just kind of listening to her, but I noticed my stomach was tightening. And I said, oh, my lizard doesn't like this talk. So I tried to figure out what my lizard was looking at, and it visualized her as a big cannon that was slowly swinging around and was going to aim at me shortly.
Wow.
And so here my lizard was all tense, but I in my mind was knowing she was just talking about North Idaho drivers. So it's like there were two of us, and I had to respect my lizard. And what were really crazy was about an hour and a half later, I was noticing that my stomach is a good sign that my lizard is active. And I noticed that I was criticizing somebody I work with, and my stomach was tightening again. And I finally figured out, oh, I understand my lizard. It's seeing complaining going on. It's seeing criticism going on, and it's scared of it, and it doesn't know whether I'm doing it or whether my wife's doing it.
Mm.
So that was learning its language, its point of view. And I can tell my lizard, you shouldn't be bothered by criticism. And it will just shut me down and put me in a coma.
Right. So instead, what do you do?
I actually take care of it. You know, I've learned that the lizard wants to be taken care of, wants to be assured that it's safe.
Mm-hmm.
And the best source of that is yourself. If you learn to say phrases and think phrases and do things that comfort your lizard, it will be very happy with you.
So in the case of your lizard reacting to criticism, either from you or to you or to the Idaho drivers, what do you say? What is the dialogue?
Well, the first thing is I validate the lizard.
Okay.
Because I actually hold the lizard in being valid. Okay, so you're scared of criticism. Okay, so let's see if we can just drop criticism for a while and see how that affects you. And by doing that, by addressing the lizard, it tends to relax.
Well, it's like a little kid,
yeah,
who's having a tantrum, and you say, you drop down on your knees and you say, okay, I'm listening to you, tell me.
Perfect. I like that image. Because I do think
of the lizard. Go to your room and be quiet. There's nothing to make a fuss about.
Yeah, yeah. I think that, what I do is I tend to take my lizard off someplace where it's not surrounded by things that scare it. Or I give it things that it loves. You know, I take it to, my lizard loves ice cream.
Funny, mine does too. Lots of it.
It loves ice cream. It also loves cinnamon toast. It loves some of the comfort food that I was given as a little kid. I think lizards are only about 4 or 5 years old.
Yeah, that's why my lizard doesn't like spinach. Gosh, anybody else over there whose lizard really likes spinach?
Let me get away from that phone. I love the lizard because it's so mechanical and so direct and so simple and so easy to talk to, you know, to deal with. Once you make acquaintance with it and start respecting it and start admiring it and say, look, you keep me alive.
Yes, 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 yes,
you know,
yes.
Here's this beautiful little guy inside. Sandra says they're all masculine, so I don't have any basis for that. So I'll go.
I think she's right.
Is this little guy inside of you, little leprechaun, and it's been keeping you alive. It watches over you all night long. You go to sleep because you love your lizard. Because
yeah, that's a great piece. I hadn't thought of it that way. I mean, as aware as I am of the lizard, I hadn't thought about the gratitude part of it. So I really like that.
Oh, it's wonderful. And every so often it gets wigged out by Aunt Martha or by something, and it's not so hard to take care of.
Yeah.
But that's all about boundaries. If you understand the subject of boundaries, I had to write a paper on boundaries.
Well, we're going to have to talk about that too.
But listen,
we have like 15 minutes left. And,
okay.
So tell me more about your journey, because I want to get to the bottom of that.
Okay, so I went and got trained in first of all, I read the book.
Okay.
Redlined the book. Gave it to my wife. She looked at the red lines and threw it across the room.
Wow. What? A lizard was up. What was up with
that? Obviously. She ain't going to be told what to do. She ain't going to be told she's defective. All those red lines looked like finger points.
Okay. Well, that's a pretty big mark, a pretty big request or invitation for intimacy when you give someone a book that you've underlined.
Yeah, yeah. It can be really terrible. I mean, I think of the number of
people really great, but
who read my papers and hand them to somebody and they want to throw them. A friend of mine said most of his books are under somebody's bed gathering, you know, dust. But he doesn't care because they're still buying them.
Well, okay. I'm not going to ask for a name, so that's okay. All right. So
John Lee.
All right.
John Lee, the author, writes about emotions and pretty nice guy.
Threw the book.
Excuse me? She threw the book, and then about 2 months later, she bought her own copy and read it, and then she got really excited, and we bought copies for all our kids. And then we decided to try to learn to do the therapy. We still didn't know what we were doing, but we liked it. And so we went into, this is a long story. We went into training.
Both of you?
With Harville Henstock, together. Yeah. And that was quite, it really changed. It, actually, in the training, we learned more about doing it than we ever learned from the book. In fact, the training was quite different from the book.
And you trained with him personally?
No, there was, at that point, there were probably, 10 different people who were doing training in the country that he had trained. Maybe 15, I don't know.
Okay, okay.
And one of them happened to come out to Boise, Idaho, so we went down there for training three different times. And it was awesome. And then we started doing that, and then I was trained. The major feature of Imago Therapy is a weekend workshop, and so I became trained to do that. That was another. That was down in Texas, Austin, Texas. By the time I was through with that, we kept on working on our relationship, because really I was doing this to make my relationship better with my wife, because I didn't want no damn more divorcing.
Right, right. And she was partnering with you on that, right?
And she was partnering with me. We had good motivation. Oh, boy, we were talking just the other day about it. Both of us had consciously or unconsciously decided that we would commit suicide rather than divorce.
Wow. Had she been divorced before?
She had been divorced before.
Okay.
So that's pretty good motivation.
Suicide before divorce. That's commitment.
That's pretty heavy motivation.
Yeah, okay.
Now, I don't know whether either one of us would have done it, but that was the motivation.
Yeah.
And we didn't share that, but it kept us going. Then we began to find places where Imago Therapy didn't solve the problem. So that's what actually, because I'm acute and a technician, I would say, well, why isn't this working?
Mm-hmm.
And then I would find out why it's not working, and then I fixed it. And that's what's happened on my website. All these papers are my notes to myself, almost most of them are, on the things that Imago didn't teach.
Mm-hmm.
So the lizard paper that you read evolved out of a lecture that Harville gave, and it's just extended until I couldn't find anything more that needed to be said on the subject.
Wow, yeah, okay. And for you listening, everyone listening, I'm going to give you Al's website too, because I don't want to forget. It's al.turtlecounseling.com. So al.turtlecounseling.com. And you will find so much on there. So much, so much, so much, so much, so much, so much. So
I think if you go to Google and you put Al Turtle Lizard, it will immediately go to my paper.
Yes.
There's a whole bunch of, for some reason or other, Google favors me. I don't know why.
Well, because Google's smart.
But it's just, thank you.
But there's a lot more than the lizard. I mean, the lizard is fabulous, and there is also a lot more. One of the things I really was hoping to talk about was vintage love.
Uh-huh.
Do you think that's where you are now?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we've been.
How long did it take to get there?
Give
us the three stages quickly that you had identified. First, second, and then vintage love.
Most of my models I try to make simple.
Yep.
I try to keep them down to a small number. That's been a trait of my life. I'm lazy mentally. So,
well, it works really well, because when I pass it on to clients, it's easy.
Yeah.
You know, three steps, I can get that.
Yeah. So for example, vintage love has five qualities to it.
But give us the first two loves, the first two, before we get to vintage love.
In the thing I created was this thing called a map of relationships, and it was basically a roadmap of how all relationships operate.
Oh, and that's so helpful.
That's worth a lot. I finally figured that out and put it together by 1998. And published it, and anyone can get it, and people read it, and it's there. You can listen to it on MP3 files, and it's a nice picture. But basically, it pointed out that relationships tend to have three phases before you reach the goal. And in our country, the first phase is romantic love.
Okay.
which is a foretaste. It's a taste. It's a teaser. It's a piece of marketing.
Oh, I like that. Piece of marketing.
For Vintage Love.
Okay, teaser marketing.
It's basically saying, come into my store, get married to this woman, this man, and you will get Vintage Love.
Oh, wow, I like that.
Fortunately, it's bullshit, because there's a lot of work between the beginning and getting Vintage Love.
Yes. And that's, we don't always wait it out.
Well, most people don't.
Right.
I'd say right now, since most people or large majority of people who set up a relationship don't marry, the divorce rate's probably, for first marriages, is probably in the 80-85%.
Yeah.
You
mean for relationships? Because
for relationships, yeah.
Okay, yeah, got it.
Yeah. Yeah, for relationships, probably 85% of them go a month, 2 months, or something like that, and then they hit the power struggle and they leave.
Okay, so stage one, romantic love. Stage two.
Stage one is a hot, cool, wonderful, delightful, high energy, high sex, high all sorts of stuff, dreamy state of I'm irresponsible and everything's going to be fine from now on.
Yes.
And it feels wonderful. And when I find a client who's in that stage, I just tell them to go away because there's nothing wrong with them. Come back when the hell hits the when the fan. When the stuff hits the fan.
Yeah,
I just
yeah.
tell them, when the stuff hits the fan, come talk to me. Because the second stage is classically all over the country called the power struggle.
Yeah.
I don't think that's what it is, but it looks like that. It looks like both people, because to me, it's a frantic attempt to use terrible tactics to try to get back into that romantic love.
Oh, instead of going forward towards the vintage love.
Or instead of moving forward.
Yeah.
But it's a frantic attempt, so at least the idea of vintage love is still there, but you're using tactics that don't work. So if you're listening to Dr. Phil or you're listening to me, the phrase, is that working for you?
Yeah.
Will be used lots and lots of times.
Yes, yes, yes.
Because
yes.
The power struggle is characterized by separating out the things that do work from the things that don't, and you're left with the things that don't. So, for example,
that can go on for a long time, and that's when the work that Al does becomes so important, because when we get to those years, that's when we need education, support, understanding, understanding what's happening, so we can get to the other side.
Yeah, I think you need to be reminded you're not crazy.
Yes, and that you haven't necessarily picked the wrong person.
You haven't picked the wrong person. But you're acting with that person, and they're acting with you in such a way that is just obnoxious.
And painful.
And doesn't work.
Okay.
And you're doing the same thing over and over again, expecting something new. You know, that's just stubbornness.
Yep.
And so that goes on for a while until finally you either give up in two levels. You either give up that relationship and go find somebody else.
And start the cycle again.
And start the cycle all over again, dreamy, dreamy, dreamy. Or you give up ever having a good relationship, and that's where most people in their 60s are.
You just settle.
It's just kind of like my parents, where they just live together.
Yeah.
Or then you start saying, no, this thing called, you know, this delightful thing called love is worth getting, so we're going to get it. And you go work on that. And that's the journey to learn new skills, learn stuff that works. And that's what my website's all about. What are those skills you need to learn?
Yes.
And they're not unlimited, and they don't go on forever. They come to an end, and you got them all. Then, once you've learned all those skills, you're still going to run into these wounds that happened in childhood. And that's when you heal the wounds. You're going to have to heal the wounds, too. I remember I said there were two different things.
Yes.
Yeah, one is learning how to have all the skills that make a good relationship, plus you're going to have to heal the wounds that your partner brings to you and that you bring to your partner.
And do you think that happens as you learn your skills, something clicks and goes, now you have them, let's put them to work?
Yeah, it's tough because they're probably, you know, 6-7 major skills, but you can't learn one and then next year learn the next and next.
Right.
You got to learn them all at the same time. And you start working on healing the wounds. And all I do is I separate out the frustrations. Frustration is a sign that there's some sort of problem to be worked on. And I separate the frustrations out from the fact that your partner doesn't know the hell how to have a relationship from the frustrations that are there because a childhood wound is stirred up.
Yeah.
And
so then
I
you
separate
can
those
seeing your partner
out.
As this wonderful person who's partnering with you in healing the wounds as opposed to the one who's bringing him to you.
Yeah. Yeah. So I mean, your partner, in a way of looking at it, you always fall in love with a perfect lab partner for your college course and moving into vintage love.
I love that.
Because this partner is going to keep on provoking you in an exact area where you have poorly developed skills until you develop those skills well, and then they'll keep on still pushing you, but it won't bother you anymore because you have good skills.
Yeah. So, so can we do a show about the skills? Not that I'm asking you on the air or putting you on the spot or anything. Okay, we can talk later.
Well, as long as you're enjoying it, I love talking. I'm a needy guy.
Good.
I told you, I'm a needy guy. And therefore, if somebody wants to talk to me or let me chat at them, I'll do it.
Okay, I'll let you chat at me. You got it. Merry Christmas, Laura.
I'm just letting you know that if I'm sitting on a plane going down to Mexico next month, which I will be doing, and if the person next to me says, oh, talk to me about relationships, or if they walk up a beach and they say, I've heard you do stuff with relationships, could you tell me about, I'll get excited.
See, that's why you're so good at what you do. And there's so much to share. I mean, I know that, you know, we have 2 minutes left, so it's it's ridiculous. I'm telling you, lizard, so it has 2 minutes to.
That's okay. That's good structure.
But you know, I know we've kind of switched back and forth, but this is such a good little taster of, okay. You know, send everyone go to Al's site, and then he and I will talk, and hopefully we can do some more structured, specific work, because those skills are magnificent.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the 6-7 skills, they are so, so, so helpful. And so to finish the chronology here, we do get to vintage love.
Mm-hmm.
You are in vintage love.
Yes. Yes. People do. I think anyone who falls in love has a partner who's falling in love and is now fighting with that partner. You're probably with the right person. There are lots of right people possible out there, but you can only handle one at a time. And this is a candidate to get to vintage love with if you learn enough.
And I think that's just exactly where I want to leave this, because, I mean, as you know, people who come to see me, that's where they are. Should I leave? Should I?
Sure.
And having heard that is so, so, so wonderful. So, of course, I want to talk with you some more. And
sure.
And we'll see how we can make this happen. I really hope that we can make this happen. I thank you from the bottom of my heart for coming and giving us a taste of your wisdom.
Hope it was fun too.
But it's so fun, so fun, so fun. Such an honor for me, and so much fun. And there's so much more to learn. I mean, this is just a little taste, you guys. But I will talk with Alan and see what else we can do. But thank you, thank you, thank you. And you two have a wonderful, wonderful Christmas.
I will have a great Christmas. And the only thing you know is Sandra and I take lots of vacations, and we're going off in January.
That's okay. We'll figure it out. You take tons of vacation. You go enjoy, and we'll figure it out. We will talk in the next few days. And
okay, Laura.
What we can make work. Thank
Great.
You, thank you, thank you, thank
Say
you so
Laura.
Much, Al.
Take care.
Take care, you too. Thank you for joining us, you guys, today. I hope that you enjoyed it half as much as I did, which was a heck of a lot. I will meet you next Tuesday, same place. We will talk with Pamela Whibble, who is going to talk to us about some seriously great healthcare. I ran into Pamela on through an article where she was interviewed for Sun Magazine, and she's got some pretty alternative ways to think about not so much the healthcare, but the way that a doctor's visit should look like. And I'm really excited to share her with you. So everybody have a great Christmas and whatever you're going to do. And I will talk with you next week, the day after my birthday. So send me good birthday wishes. Big hugs to everyone. Have a great week. Bye-bye.